Good morning. It is great to see you guys today. My name is T.W. Davis. I'm the lead pastor here at High Point, and it is it's great that you've joined us to move forward in our Lent series called Wanderings, Wonderings, right? Where we're looking at the wandering journey of the Israelites and the wonderings or the questions that they bring to both God and to Moses. Before we get any further, I have a confession to make. You know, there are things in this life that just irrationally annoy you, right? Like we all have those things. For me, mine is whining. And I really don't like it when my son does it. And he's five, so sometimes he can't help it, and so I try my best to redirect him, hey, I will hear what you want to say, but I need you to use your real voice, not that whiny voice. Even if it's not a whine, if it's just a complaint, it feels bothersome. And it's not just my son, right? There are people who, when I was a youth pastor, there were people who complained about how difficult and impossible the youth are. And now that I'm a lead pastor, there are people that complain about how difficult the old people are. Not my words, theirs. Or people that feel the need to always bring up their petty problems, or talk about how terrible politicians or the government is, or how the road in front of us is always being worked on, but it's never fixed. What is happening? Or the worst, right? People who complain, they're the worst, aren't they? And just to make the irony crystal clear, I grumble about grumblers here. And when I do that, I become the biggest grumbler of all. And see, that's the thing about grumbling, right? We always think it's other people that are the grumblers, not us. That's what other people do. What do? Well, we have justified complaints. Or we have constructive criticism. Yes. Because we don't grumble. We are the exception. But in reality, I'm here to tell you, most of us grumble, and some of us grumble a lot. And during this time, when the Israelites have made it past the Red Sea, God has saved them and kept the Egyptians from pursuing them any further, we have grumbling. At the end of chapter 15, the people find a spring to get water, but as they're drinking that spring water, they find out that it's bitter, and they call that spring, the spot where that spring is, they call it Marah, which means bitter. But not just because the water is bitter. The people are turning bitter as well. And we're going to look at some specific grumbles in the journey next few weeks. And we're going to look at their bitter attitude. But today we're going to look at the story surrounding manna. Next week we're going to talk about the water that God provides. But starting out in chapter 16, the Israelites have been saved from God in the Red Sea crossing. They found a grotto of fresh water after the bitter one, and now they're traveling further into the wilderness towards the promised land. And then they start to grumble again. Exodus chapter 16, verse 2. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the hands of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full, for you've brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I'm about to rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go and gather a day's portion every day that I may test them, whether they'll walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it'll be twice as much as they gather daily." So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, "At evening, you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning, you'll see the glory of God, because he's heard your grumbling against the Lord. For what are we that you grumble against us?" And Moses said, when the Lord gives you in the evening meat to eat, in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord's heard your grumbling, that you grumble against him, what are we? Your grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord. I asked Vicky on Wednesday, hey, how are you doing with your memorization? Is there anything I can do to help you out? You know, are we looking good for Sunday? And she said, ooh, there's a lot of grumbling in this passage. I said, I know, I got to preach on it. Israel has yet to learn their lesson. Not only have they not learned their lesson that God's going to provide, but they're saying hurtful things about God. They're saying that they were better off in Egypt, that the Exodus has actually made things worse. The saved nation is saying to God, we wish you hadn't bothered saving us at all. We'd wish you'd left us right where we were. Ugh. Like I read this and I thought to myself, I'm sure you're thinking it right now, you could never have that conversation with God, right? That's the attitude we have. I can never have that conversation with God. Never have that attitude. Never say to God, God, we would be better off without your influence in our lives. But that's the thing about grumbling, right? That's what other people do, not us. I looked it up. One of the marks of grumbling is to posit unrealistic and idealized alternatives. In chapter 2, the same people that were crying out to God, asking for help, asking for salvation, asking for freedom, are the same ones that are here in this chapter. When they got what they wanted, they're still grumbling about how they wish they were back in Egypt. The things were terrible enough when they were in Egypt to ask for emancipation, but now as they look back on it, things in Egypt, not so bad, right? I mean, Egypt was a wonderful place to live. The slave drivers who whipped them, gave them less supplies, told them they had to make more bricks, and gave them less food, that's not a big deal, right? All that's forgotten. They even go so far in verse 3 as to insinuate that God is the one who oppressed them in Egypt, and it's God's intention to be harmful to them. What a group of people, huh? We look at this attitude of the Israelites and go, what are you doing? We would never say anything like that, right? So what does God do to this grumbling? What is God's response to this grumbling? He provides. And what does he provide? Manna from heaven. God provides for his people just like they should have known that he was going to. In the evenings, quail comes, they trap it for the meat. In the morning, sitting on the dew is a flakes of a substance that is like bread. This stuff's so foreign to them that they actually name it their first response to it. Manna, which in Hebrew means, what is it? When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it's the bread the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each one of you, for as much as you can eat. You shall take one omer according to the number of persons to each of you has in his tent. And the people of Israel did so. It's the bread that the Lord has given to you. Gather what you need. Remember in verse 4 and 5, God said they had to gather everything they needed for that day, except day 6. They had to gather double, so that the next day on the Sabbath, they wouldn't do any work. They had to trust God every single day, day in and day out. Manna requires you to trust God, to look for God's provision every single day. Trust him one day at a time. That's why the manna didn't last longer than a day. The Bible says leftover manna on the ground just melted away. You can't collect in one day enough for the whole week. That's not how it works. And Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it over till the morning. But they didn't listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning, they gathered it, and as much as he could eat, but when the sun grew hot, it melted. This is a hard lesson to learn, right? To trust God daily with his provision. Some of the people tried to save manna for the next day. They trusted their efforts, their logic, their feelings, their savings. They trusted their provisions. This is a little ridiculous to me because I don't even like leftovers. My wife loves leftovers. And I think sometimes it's just because she's not a fan of food waste. It has nothing to do with the actual taste of the food. But in her defense, leftover pizza is pretty good. The Israelites might have had trust issues. They might have been like my wife and hated the concept of food waste. But whatever the case, it made them feel better to look at the jar of leftover manna when they go to sleep and know that they are secure in their savings. These Israelites probably put a bunch of leftover manna in their specialized manna jar. Their specialized manna jar that probably was in reality some big treasure from Egypt that they had taken. And when they opened that jar the next morning, in their specialized manna jar, there is maggots and it stinks. The point is, there's no alternative to trusting God every single day and trust that he will provide for tomorrow. One of the ways God also asked us to trust him is with that seventh day, the Sabbath, the day of rest. Trusting God in our rest is tough for us. It was tough for the Israelites as well. On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain each of you in his place. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. God told them, I got this. And they still went out together on the seventh day. One of the ways we demonstrate our love, our trust in God, is that we rest. And we can rest because we're trusting God to provide. But let's look at the flip side of that. If you can't rest, if you're too busy with your work or your family or your ministry, problem is you don't trust God like you're supposed to. You're trying to secure your own future, create your own identity, provide your own justification. You can sit there and make excuses. I'll listen to them, but no, that's what it is. Excuses. Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generations, so that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. The idea of trusting God is so important that they took a jar of manna that was collected and they sealed it up and they kept it for generations and generations. And eventually put it into the Ark of the Covenant as a reminder that God will provide. And not just that he provided, but that God desires daily trust. Let's be honest. If we were the ones collecting the manna, and God gave us this massive storm of manna, and we went out and we collected enough for 365 days, for 364 of those days, we would trust that storage. And for one day, we would trust God. And that's the point that he's making. And I believe that's the concept that Jesus is pointing to when in the Lord's Prayer it says, give us this day our daily bread. talked about the need for God daily to trust in his provision, but I want you to know that trust comes in times of crisis too. When I was 14 years old, my grandparents were driving down the mountain and had a head-on collision with a tractor trailer. Killed my grandfather, crushed my grandmother's leg. She had a whole list of injuries. We weren't sure if she was going to live. We were told she'd never walk again. Just spoiler alert, she survived and walks with a cane now, so that's the answer to prayer. But during her recovery, when she finally got out of the hospital, she needed round-the-clock care because she's in a wheelchair. And so my mom and my dad and my brother and I moved into my grandmother's house because my mom said, quote, "I can't keep up with two households." So we all moved in with my grandmother. We were there for over a year. I slept on a pull-out couch for most of that time. It was a tough time for our family, I'm not going to lie. With her in a wheelchair and my mom taking a break from her work to be the caregiver, plus my mom and dad made sure my brother and I didn't miss anything at school or anywhere else we wanted to be. And sometimes you hear adults have conversations that you're not supposed to hear, especially as a teenager. I remember hearing some of my mom's friends asking her, "What are you going to do about work? What are you going to do about what your mom needs if she never gets out of the wheelchair? What are you going to do if she needs 24-hour care for the rest of her life? What does that look like? What if this? What if that?" Again, I wasn't supposed to be listening. My mom's response mirrored the attitude that Jesus called us to have in Matthew 6. "Therefore, do not be anxious about tomorrow. For tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble." My mom said, sometimes with tears in her eyes, I remember her saying, "I don't know what we'll do if that happens. I'm just trying to deal with today's problems, and I'll work on tomorrow's problems tomorrow. But me and God will handle this." Do you have that point of view? Or does worry eat you up? Do your grumbles get in the way of your rest? Get in the way of your peace? Are you even seen as are you seen as a grumbler even though you feel justified in your creative or constructive criticism? God provided for the grumblers and the trusting alike. But he wasn't happy with the grumblers. He rebuked them. And I don't know about you, but that's not a camp I want to be in. This morning I want to talk about what manna God has given you. I know at least most of you aren't looking for flakes on the dew every morning. Some of you might be, but we can have that conversation later. But when we talk about manna in the present, we're talking about, in theological terms, it's something called providence. And it's not a word you hear often, unless you're talking about the capital of Rhode Island. Which, by the way, Roger Williams founded the city of Providence in Rhode Island because he said, "Thank God for his merciful providence." He was kicked out of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And when they got to what is now Rhode Island, they didn't find flakes on the ground and quail just coming to them. They found plenty of game in the forest. They found fish in the streams, and that was manna enough. Someone said to me one time that life is understood backwards, but must be lived forwards. Isn't that so often the way it is with us? There are times when we feel trapped in tough situations, tough circumstances, when jobs are lost, when relationships fail, when sicknesses would intrude, when we've locked the keys in our car, You may not think at those times that God is close at hand guiding our circumstances, but I'm here to tell you that those situations, those experiences are our manna moments. Remember, manna means, what is it? You see, at the time, our situation may not feel like manna from God, but later on, with a little distance, we reflect back on what's happened and we see a pattern of loving care emerge. Very often we see the providential hand of God active in our lives in the most remarkable ways. When that happens, the place we once imagined to be wilderness is now seen as a place of blessing after all. There does come a time, though, when the manna ceases. The day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate of the produce of the land. Unleavened cakes and parched grain, and the manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land. There was no longer manna for the people of Israel, but they ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. This is Joshua chapter 5. And the day that they are first able to eat of what they've cultivated out of the land that God has given them, they awaken to discover for the first time in 40 years, minus Sabbath days, that there's no manna. And it's not because God has ceased to bless them. He hasn't ceased to be generous. It's because the people of Israel no longer need such heavenly assistance. It's not that the Lord has stopped providing. God always provides. He's simply doing it in a different way. I want you to be proactive. We are partners with the Lord. It's not like we are some kind of house pet that we should look for our meals as a cat or a dog twice a day. There are seasons where we need that manna, but God's purpose is not that. When we expand our field of vision, we'll discern the Lord at work, guiding us in ways we provide for ourselves and our loved ones. Because all we have in this world and in this life is ultimately God's generous gift. You guys ever read Lord of the Rings? A couple times. I see some shakes. Good stuff. There's a substance in the novels that function kind of like manna. Tolkien was a professor of ancient literature at Oxford. He was a deeply, deeply Christian man. And he's faced with a problem when he's writing the story. All right? Frodo and Sam are going to need some type of food as they cross the scorched volcanic hellscape that is Mordor. And he has a story problem. And he doesn't know what to do about it. And so he invented a kind of manna that they take with them. All right? He invented it. It's a gift from the elves, he says, and it's called Limbus. All right? And it's a magical bread. And it's durable. I assume it's durable like those awful soda crackers my great-grandmother made me eat that were probably 100 years old and broke my teeth. Durable, but taste amazing. And they could keep for months and months as long as they're wrapped in a certain leaf. And a bite or two is enough to sustain you for the whole day. It is the food for the righteous. And those who are evil, like the dark and twisted character Gollum, finds the taste offensive. He's so evil. He hates it so much, he refuses to eat it even when he's faced with starvation. And this is consistent with Tolkien's view of communion. From his upbringing, Christians weren't supposed to take communion unless you'd confessed your sins. It was a Latin term for the communion elements in the early 20th century that he would have known. It's called Vaticum, which means for the way. The communion wafer was understood as a spiritual provision for life's journey. And so it should come as no surprise that Tolkien refers to these lambda cakes as way bread. For him, communion is the Christian manna, which comes to believers by the hand of a generous God. Joel is going to come up. He's going to lead us in communion this morning. Our shepherds and leaders will be at the stations. And what I'm asking you to do is when we start singing, go to them and let them serve you communion this morning. Take it back to your seat and we'll take the elements together here in a minute. We're going to be at the table of the Lord. And at this table, we'll consume not manna and quail, but bread and juice, which is the body of our blood and Savior. The ultimate provision of our God to us. The cross is the measure of God's generosity, and eternity is the measure of his gift. Think on this manna from heaven today as we partake.